Yes, about 8:30 or so. So I think I'll go ahead and begin. Welcome. Thanks for coming out to get a taste of philosophy in the cinema. My name, if you didn't know it already, is Mike Van Quickenborn. And tonight I was just going to show you some examples of humor in philosophy and try and explain why I think it's important to combine philosophy and humor. I've been teaching a class called Philosophy in the Cinema at Everett Community College since 2000. And in 2008, a few years ago now, organized what I bill as the world's first philosophical film festival, which I called Philosophy in the Dark. If you weren't here yesterday, and I see that many of you weren't, I just want to let you know that after the session, if you like, up here there are copies of a filmography and bibliography that I've worked up for my course, essentially. The filmography basically gives you different sort of topics within philosophy and then more specific philosophical questions, and then films that I think really fit those questions. A couple pages of that. And then the bibliography I worked up has just listings of different sources, mostly books, but some websites as well. Books on philosophy and the cinema, books on specific films as well. A couple pages there, so you can pick that up if you'd like. If your appetite for information is still not sated, you can still go to my website, www.philosophyinthecinema.com, and I promise I won't try and sell you anything there, even though it ends in .com. But at any rate, that's the website I use for my class that I teach at Everett Community College. It's partly online. Let's see, I'm looking around. It doesn't look like I need to check ID. Tonight, there will be a few choice profanities uttered in the clips that I'm going to show, but it shouldn't be a problem. Just to make sure the word gets out if it needs to. Tomorrow night, we'll be showing Babette's Feast at 8:30 in its entirety. At 4 o'clock, I have another session, and the clips I'll be showing during that session are also kind of a PG nature, and as well on Thursday night, or Thursday actually at 10:50 in the morning, I'll have another session. And again, PG nature. So tonight's only night where we'll get to revel in some profanities. But anyway, finally, I did want to mention that the Village Bookstore has copies of Jeffrey Overstreet's book, Through a Screen Darkly, Looking Closer at Beauty, Truth, and Evil in the Movies. And that's for sale there. He is a former film critic for Christianity Today. He also happens to be a Seattleite. And I do recommend his book if you'd like to read further about a much wider variety of films analyzed from a Christian perspective. And it's a good read, and there's a lot of much more choice of films there to think about, maybe to view if you haven't seen them already, so you can pick that up. All right. As I go along tonight, if you have any questions as I'm talking, please feel free to raise your hand or interject or whatever you need to do. But the first thing I want to talk about is whether or not philosophy could be funny. If I were to ask you what you think of when you hear the word philosophy, I mean, what would you say? What comes to mind?
Serious.
Okay, serious. Socrates.
Hemlock.
Hemlock.
Hard.
Hemlock's fun. What was it? Hard. Okay, or difficult? Yeah.
Dry.
Dry. Okay. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes.
I was going to say, my idea of what philosophy is has changed, but it also goes with cinema because we watched a couple of Slavoj Žižek films.
Mm-hmm.
So now every time I hear philosophy, I'm going to think of him sitting like half naked in bed explaining what the role of the philosopher is.
Okay.
From one of those documentaries.
Okay. Yeah. That particular philosopher, Slavoj Žižek. From Croatia, right, but also teaches in the United States, I think, at this point. Very interesting person. Maybe one of the few philosophers who might be considered funny, or able to be funny, we might say. I just mentioned in that light, if you haven't seen it, there's a film called The Examined Life. It's a fairly recent film. It's a documentary where a bunch of different philosophers are interviewed just for their general views on things. Slavoj Žižek spends his time being interviewed standing in a garbage dump and praising the garbage. So he's almost in that little clip, at least, sort of the anti-environmentalist. Not that he wants to pollute the world, but just that he revels in everything that even humans do. Other noted philosophers in that film, they're interviewed are Cornel West, for example. Tidbit about him. This night will not be just about tidbits, but last night we watched a clip from The Matrix, and Cornel West is a philosopher at Harvard, and he is in the second and third Matrix films acting. So.
He's in Princeton.
Princeton, sorry, yeah. Princeton, and also recorded a rap album. Anyway, multiply talented guy, probably also one of the more humorous philosophers. But I think most people's first reaction is not that philosophy is hilarious or funny. The people we might associate with philosophy tend to be dead white males. Of course, I aspire to be that someday. individuals whose dour visages do not inspire mirth. Of course, to some extent, this is undeserved for the examples that we just heard about. Philosophers have written humorous works, and fairly recently, there's actually been a New York Times best-selling book published called Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes. It was successful, and so it was followed by two sequels, Aristotle and an Aardvark Go to Washington, Understanding Political Doublespeak Through Philosophy and Jokes, and the third title in the series, Heidegger and a Hippo Walk Through Those Pearly Gates, Using Philosophy and Jokes to Explore Life, Death, the Afterlife, and Everything in Between. The authors of those books are Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. Perhaps not surprisingly, though, both of these gentlemen did major in philosophy at Harvard University, no less. Neither pursued academic careers. Now, I'm mentioning this book. The theme of tonight is philosophy and humor. But I do have to say I don't actually recommend it. I did work my way through it, but I think it suffers from that which defeats all attempts at humor. The need to explain and or think about the jokes. In other words, to see the connections between the jokes and philosophy, the authors have to talk about how these jokes work, which of course renders them painfully unfunny, in my opinion. But you don't have to take my opinion for it, because I did want to just read a brief excerpt from Plato and a Platypus. Gives you a taste of the book. Hundreds of jokes hinge on confusing analytic a priori statements with synthetic a posteriori statements. Here's an example. There's a surefire way to live to a ripe old age. Eat a meatball a day for 100 years. Okay, kind of a chuckle there. But immediately now it's followed with, the joke lies in giving an analytic a priori solution to a problem that asks for a synthetic a posteriori solution. The question of a surefire way to longevity clearly asks for some information about the world. What are the things that experience has shown lead to longevity? We expect the answer to be something like give up smoking or take 400 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 at bedtime. But here the answer is analytic, with a little irrelevancy about meatballs thrown in to fog your mind. Quote, to live to an old age, live 100 years, because 100 years is, by common definition, an old age. Eat some meatballs too. They can't hurt you. Unquote. Well, maybe all those trans fats in the meatballs could hurt, but not, of course, if you eat them for 100 years. Yes, right. Exactly my point. Nobody's laughing. So it goes on like that. I mean, you could get the little chuckle from the joke, but then they analyze it, and you wish you hadn't read it. But at any rate, I'm being a little bit critical of them. No doubt jealous of their success. At any rate, why does it matter if philosophy isn't particularly funny? Well, philosophy deals with fundamental questions that are supposed to be very important, so why should it have to be funny? Well, actually, I think for a couple reasons it would be nice if it could be funny. First of all, funny sells. People will pay attention if something is funny. And if philosophy is so important, it would be nice if people could be paying attention to it. If something is unrelentingly serious and extremely abstract, to boot, as philosophy often is, many people will just not pay attention. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, it's extremely valuable, I think, for people to be able to laugh at themselves. And to the extent that philosophy and philosophers and humor are mutually exclusive, it will be harder to take oneself less seriously than one ought to. To illustrate my point there, you might think of the film The Matrix, which many people have seen. I did show a little clip last night. But if you haven't seen it, briefly, in that film, a bunch of very serious philosophers come warriors take it upon themselves to free those still trapped in the Matrix, which is this illusion that's being perpetrated upon innocent people by artificial intelligence. And they take it upon themselves to free those still trapped in the Matrix, even if they end up having to kill many of them in the process, which is kind of goes on throughout the film. Lots of people are dying. It's no accident, I think, that the Zionistas, that's not a reference to Israel, by the way, in the film, people who are sort of fighting artificial intelligence keep talking about this sort of main city called Zion, and so I call them Zionistas. And it's no accident that they are a decidedly humorless lot. As I have actually argued, they ought to have tried a different approach to dealing with the AI, perhaps a nonviolent Christ-like approach. Neo's supposed to be Christ-like, but you know, he's all about kicking butt in the film. So at any rate, the violent conflict of the Matrix is purely fiction, but clearly history includes many violent conflicts born out of philosophical conflict. So even though that's fiction, certainly people get very worked up about their philosophical ideas to the point where they're willing to kill or hurt other people. And if there's a little bit more humor involved in philosophy, that might not be the case. So, who has attempted to produce philosophy in a more humorous light? A few people that we heard earlier. But I think the genre of film comedy is another that has philosophical implications. In my class, Philosophy in the Cinema, I use several comedies to touch on a variety of philosophical issues. From The Truman Show, if you've seen that one. This one addresses the question of how do we know what is really real. Another film called Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story, which is actually a sort of a very early, you might call, postmodern novel. Talk more about postmodernism tomorrow at 4. But that movie has also been described as a novel that's completely unfilmable. You can watch the movie and see whether or not that was the case. But in that film, I think it really raises the question of whether or not truth is relative. There's another film that actually we'll be looking at tomorrow at 4 called Adaptation, which I think raises the question as to whether or not truth even exists. Groundhog Day, older Bill Murray vehicle, I think addresses the question of what is the meaning of life. There's a Coen Brothers film, Intolerable Cruelty, which most people don't really like, but I'm kind of a fan of it, even though I don't like a lot of their films as much. Intolerable Cruelty, I think, raises the question as to how important money is. Modern Times, the old Charlie Chaplin film from, the 1920s, asks how ought society be organized. Has an interesting take on capitalism. There's a film called Enlightenment Guaranteed, which is part documentary about a Buddhist monastery and part sort of road trip movie. And it really raises the question as to whether or not everything is interconnected. I'm almost done with my list. And Ma Vie en Rose is a Belgian-French production that really asks the question as to what our essential qualities are. Tonight, I wanted to look at more closely at two other films, I Heart Huckabees and Being John Malkovich. So that's what we'll be doing for the rest of this session. Right. Any questions here about any of those films that I've listed? The film, I want to give a little context before I show the clip here. The film I Heart Huckabees begins when the main character, Albert Markovsky, well, it actually begins in this stream of profanities, but anyway, begins when the main character, we're not going to see that part, when the main character, Albert Markovsky, played by Jason Schwartzman, he's an environmental activist and poet, and he's extremely frustrated by his inability to protect a marsh from development by a corporation kind of akin to Walmart, but it's known as Huckabees in the film. And what he's trying to do at the beginning of the film is he's trying to understand a series of coincidental meetings with a tall African man. You'd wonder why he'd want to know about this, but he runs into this tall African guy several times. He lives in, it seems like, Los Angeles, so it seems a little bit strange. And he wants to understand what's the meaning behind these coincidences. Albert is the kind of guy who wants to know what it all means. Meaning is very important to him. To assist him in figuring this out, he has done something that none of us would do. He has hired two existential detectives. And these two detectives are played by Dustin Hoffman and Lily Tomlin. You'll see them briefly. You'll see them briefly at the end of the clip I'm going to show you. They, the existential detectives, are essentially offering Albert a Buddhist outlook on the world. They don't call it such, but it really amounts to as much. Albert also encounters another person by the name of Catherine Vauban, who's played by Isabelle Huppert, and she is a nihilist, so she's sort of the anti-existential detectives. And she would teach she would teach him a very different lesson about the meaning of it all, and she attempts to do that in the film. I know this sounds very confusing, and it is a little bit, but Albert, right, the environmentalist, he's paired by the existential detectives with another character by the name of Tommy Korn, who's played by Mark Wahlberg, and you'll see him in this clip. And Tommy is also facing an existential crisis of his own, perhaps partially as a result of being a first responder in New York City during 9/11. Tommy Korn's crisis really centers on our society's need for petroleum. He really is just anti-petroleum. Okay. As far as Tommy sees it, this need for petroleum is destroying the planet and problematically embroiling us in the Middle East, leading to things like 9/11, as he says at one point in the film. Now, in the scene that I'm about to show you, Albert and Tommy have tracked down Stephen Ninieri, who is the African man, played by Gerard Dewani. And Stephen has invited these two people into his house to have dinner with him and his adopted family. Yeah, actually, it turns out he's one of the lost boys from Sudan, and they've adopted him into their family. So I'll show you that clip. It's about 7 minutes, and then we'll talk about it. And if you have any questions or have any comments, that would be great. So now I move the high-tech box here. And if somebody could hit the lights, I guess it worked pretty well last night to turn them all off. Thank you.
There's three.
There's another switch to the, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
One,
that's great.
One more. One more.
But deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.
Stephen, how'd you end up working as a doorman?
She's a highly immigration agreement. You must work.
The billing supervisor heard Stephen as a member of our congregation.
You're so skinny when you moved in here. You didn't know what a can opener was.
Right.
You opened cans with a big knife while you're a refugee camp.
Right.
And there aren't lines going around here, but there were in Sudan, and the orphan boys got chased.
You always get this wrong.
They got bit his right head off.
There's no orphan in Africa.
He wanted to know where all the meat comes from since he didn't see a cow around.
Guys, what about Albert? What brought you to the philosophical club?
You mean the existential detectives?
Sounds like a support group.
Why can't he use the church?
Sometimes people have additional questions to be answered.
Like what?
For instance, if the forms of this world die, Which is more real, the me that dies or the me that's infinite? Can I trust my habitual mind, or do I need to learn to look beneath those things?
Sounds like we got a philosopher.
Philosopher, yeah.
We have to ask those kinds of questions too.
No.
What happened to the cat, Albert?
How did you know about my cat?
Cat was killed by curiosity.
Thank you.
Oh, what'd you do?
Yeah, I'm the director of the Open Spaces Coalition. We fight suburban sprawl.
What's suburban sprawl?
Why don't you ask Stephen? You could use a little suburban sprawl in Sudan.
Excuse me, that?
Industry, houses, jobs, restaurants, medicine.
You can preserve a lot of open space and have jobs for people with
it. I beg your pardon, Albert, I wasn't finished.
Sorry, sir.
Clothes, videos, toys, cheeseburgers, cars, a functioning economy.
You can still have a functioning economy and preserve open spaces with a little planning.
Yeah.
Socialism.
Theodore Roosevelt was a socialist, and William Butler Yeats, Elizabeth Bishop, Henry David Thoreau, Robinson Jeffers, National Geographic Societies, were all socialists.
You're talking about socialism.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about not covering every square inch of populated America with houses and strip malls until you can't even remember what happens when you stand in a meadow at dusk. What happens in a meadow at dusk?
Nothing.
Everything.
Everything!
I work for an electrical engineering firm, son, and we do a lot of commercial and residential contracts. And if development stops, so does my paycheck. Then Stephen couldn't be here as our guest, could he? So your ideas hurt Stephen.
I'm not hurting Stephen. That's an outrageous accusation.
Don't use that tone of voice.
Well, I think you started that tone, sir. I think it's entirely possible for your engineering firm to have jobs for people, preserve open spaces, have contracts, do...
Whoa. What's he doing?
Why is he closing his eyes?
Do you have a job, Tom?
I'm a firefighter.
Oh, God bless you. A hero.
I'm not a hero. We'd all be heroes if we could use a patrolman, though.
Excuse me?
You say you're Christians living by Jesus' principles, but are you?
Yeah, of course not.
Jesus is never mad at us if we live with him in our hearts.
I hate to break it to you, but he is. He most definitely is.
All right, that's enough. I don't know what this is about. Why? Here.
Sorry, Mom. Sorry, Dad. I didn't know.
Steve-O, I'm so disappointed.
Look, he's sad. Look, he's sad.
I'm sorry, Steve-O. My bad. You didn't know. You should be ashamed of yourself.
I should be what?
You should be ashamed of yourself.
And why is that? Why should I be ashamed of myself?
You're a hypocrite.
I don't want
you misleading these children. Because you're the destroyer, man.
How am I the destroyer? I saw that SUV out there.
Oh, my car's the destroyer.
Well, I don't need money for a gallon, I guess.
Stephen, I really need to ask you a question. It's why I came here. Why are autographs so important to you?
This is the first time with this family since they have talked to me. Which I can now carry on.
It's just for fun. It's for entertainment. No names at the table, please.
Yes. 260 and I've reached the Omega level.
You know we can measure level.
God gave us oil. He gave it to us. How did God gift me bad?
Well, I don't know. He gave you a brain, too, and you messed that up pretty damn good.
Oh, you sons of bitches out of my house now.
If Hitler were alive, he'd tell you not to think about oil.
You're the Hitler! We took a Sudanese refugee into our home!
You did. But how did Sudan happen, man? Could it possibly be related to dictatorships that we support for some stupid reason?
You shut up! You get out!
You shut up! Come on, let's get out of here.
Hey, Steve. God bless you.
Wow.
Oh, man. That's
crazy. Hi, guys. Hey, did you guys need anything good in there?
You didn't, did
you? No.
We just gave our permission of a cat. What does that mean?
It means nothing, just like my coincidence.
Cats seem to hit a nerve.
Yeah, I had a cat once. You taught me. You guys are great. You're amazing.
The method worked. I saw it. Seemed to calm you down, right?
What method? Come on with that method. All right, that's a tranquilizer so people don't get pissed about the painful ugly truth. You know it.
No, Tommy, it penetrates a unified infinity of everything.
We're not in infinity, we're in the suburbs.
Infinity is everywhere, that's what makes it infinity.
Okay, how does this connect? This Nigeria is an orphan from Sudan who was chased by soldiers and crocodiles. So how did the love boat get into that, man?
It's connected. Albert and the familiarity share a great deal. We connect just that hole. Oh, my God.
What's she doing here?
It's Katarine.
Oh, this is worse than I thought.
Oh, much worse.
The meeting's going down at Huckabee's right now. Let's go. Hey, everybody! Calm down!
The national office recognizes the charter. We're here today to give the director a chance to even the keel.
Okay. More shouting and violence ensues, but anyway, if... I don't know, if we have light switch over here, too?
Oh, okay. Thank you.
I'll move the box.
Thank you.
thanks. I do just want to say that probably more than any other scene in that film, this one does sum up the whole film pretty nicely. There's a lot else going on in there, and there's another main character who runs the Huckabee's Corporation, or doesn't run it, but is a big player in that, who plays a role. But I don't know, any questions or comments here initially? Reactions?
Who wrote the film?
Who wrote the film? I believe, well, David O. Russell was the director. He's just came out with his latest film, The Fighter. Was up for Best Film in the last Academy Awards. I think he wrote it as well. I'm not 100% certain about that, but I believe so.
Director. What's the name of the father, the actor?
Oh, I don't remember. I've seen him before, too, but I don't remember.
He was in The Visitor, I believe.
Okay.
Did you see that movie, The Visitor, where he befriends a couple who are living in his apartment in New York?
I haven't seen that one yet.
I think he's the same actor.
If you haven't heard of the Internet Movie Database, imdb.com, it's a great resource. You can look up any film. It'll list all the actors, directors, writers, everything whatever want to know about a film. Just to throw that in there. Anything else there? Okay, well, in this film and in this clip, you've got two individuals searching after meaning. They're confronting those who think they have life's meaning completely figured out. And I'm talking about the family, of course. And that family, it seems, they don't really want to consider all the consequences of their actions. They want to think about what it all means. And at the end of the scene, you see the representatives of the two opposing views, the existential detectives, Dustin Hoffman and Lily Tomlin, who see all of reality as interconnected, and they have really an optimistic, hopeful spin, I think, on reality, versus the view of the woman in the car there that you see, and she is a nihilist, and she basically thinks, and if you see the whole film, you'd get this, but she thinks that life is a meaningless struggle, that everything is pointless. A great image that she suggests in the film is, you know, Albert wants to preserve the marsh and the trees and so forth, the environment, and she just says, look, they're all going to be cut down anyway, so you might as well just let it go. So Albert and Tommy go back and forth between those two views, and I think one thing that's interesting about this film is it doesn't settle on, okay, the existential detectives are correct and the nihilist is wrong. In the end, they take something of both views and sort of realize that they have to keep struggling, but that won't necessarily go the way they want, but that they should continue to struggle to preserve the environment, to struggle against these other corporate forces. With this film and with all the films that I offer in my philosophy of the cinema class, I always pair the film with usually a couple different philosophical writings. For this one, I use some writings of the Zen master Charlotte Joko Beck, who recently passed away, as well as Aldo Leopold, if you've heard of him. Aldo Leopold has argued that a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. So you might think the environment. And for Leopold, then, the beauty of the world is its own value, and as with any valuable thing, we ought to treat it as valuable. That's a point that these characters, Albert and Tommy, understand, and they're willing to act on. In contrast with Stephen's family, they're committed to seeing the world itself as valuable, not just human interests as the sole arbiter of value. And I think that's, you know, one of the philosophical messages that gets asserted here in this film. As my students see Albert and Tommy question materialism in this film, I think they're both able to see that it's warranted, that it's justified, but also that it's okay to not take yourself so seriously, right? Because the film is clearly laughing at Albert and Tommy, you know, as well. and again, I think that's a valuable thing for a film to do. Unfortunately, a common affliction of those who strongly feel the tug of philosophy, especially at an early age, is a sometimes, unfortunately, sometimes literally deadly seriousness. If you were here last night, we saw a clip from the film Waking Life where somebody immolates himself. Out of frustration, you might say, with the way society is run. But aside from that very extreme example, young people who really feel the tug of philosophy really take it maybe too seriously if they can find an idea that they really you know, identify with and want to cling to. And I think seeing a film like this might help to, you know, again, dissipate some of that. At any rate, any other questions about that film? Or? All right. Another example of a humorous film, which I do want to show you a bit of here tonight, and it has very interesting and serious philosophical implications, is a 1999 Spike Jonze, Charlie Kaufman film, Being John Malkovich. This film takes a fairly familiar plot device, having a character switch bodies with somebody else. So one film that comes to mind, and I'm sure you can think of others, is Freaky Friday, right? That old Disney film was remade fairly recently where people switch bodies. And I guess Big is another one, right? But there are lots of others where people somehow can switch bodies in some way. This film, Being John Malkovich, does the same thing. But this film, Being John Malkovich, uses this, I think, as a vehicle for investigating the nature of personhood, which is a very old topic in philosophy that to this day has not been resolved to the satisfaction of most philosophers. So I'll set up the clip I'm going to show you, and then I'll talk to you about the clip and the various philosophical questions that get raised in the film. The main character is Craig Schwartz, who's played by John Cusack, and he's a puppeteer who has recently begun employment as an office worker in a very strange building with ceilings that are half height. There's some obscure reason for this, apart from the fact that it sets up a joke that's made in the film, that companies that have offices on that floor have low overhead and can pass these savings on to their customers. So, at any rate, it's also relevant to mention that Craig, though married, has unrequited romantic feelings for somebody who works in the same floor by the name of Maxine. She's played by Catherine Keener. And you'll see her in the second half of this clip. Aside from that, I think the clip will speak for itself. Though I do have to just take a couple of seconds here to cue it up. I should have asked, had any of you seen I Heart Huckabees before? Okay, a few of you. How about Being John Malkovich? Okay, many more. By the way, I'll mention this today, maybe to entice you to come tomorrow. One of the films I'm going to show clips of tomorrow is called Adaptation. It's also a product of Spike Jonze, the director of this film, and Charlie Kaufman, the screenwriter for this film. Adaptation is it's not a sequel at all, but it kind of follows on that success. Thank you.
Go away.
The Broadhurst Theater, please.
Hey, say, you see that actor guy?
Yes.
Yeah, Malkovich?
Malkovich.
Right here, okay. Okay, yeah, I thought you were right about one movie.
Thank you.
You played a
jewel thief? I never played a jewel thief.
Huh? Who am I saying now?
I don't know.
No. No, I'm pretty sure we do.
Any questions about that? that sort of starts the whole film from there in terms of the philosophical questions, I guess you could say. One of the things that this film attempts to do that others in a similar sort of vein don't attempt to do is that this film tries to show what it might be like to inhabit another body, right? As you see the vision of Malkovich that Craig Schwartz is somehow seeing out of Malkovich's eyes. And so apparently Craig is able to perceive undetected everything that John Malkovich perceives for about 15 minutes. And then, as he says, he spit out into the side of the New Jersey Turnpike. It does, I think, open up a metaphysical can of worms. And so we might wonder, when Craig is in Malkovich, from an outsider's perspective, who is there? Is it both of them? Is it just Malkovich? Is it just Craig? I'll come back to a question like that after I say a couple other things about what goes on from here in the movie. Because Craig Schwartz, as I said, and as you heard in the clip, is a puppeteer. And due to his skills as a puppeteer, he re-enters Malkovich, and he's such a skilled puppeteer, he's able to basically take control of Malkovich's body. Okay. And so in most of the film, you will see John Malkovich acting, but it's supposed to be Craig Schwartz who's, you know, making him do whatever he's doing. And in fact, a little bit of a spoiler alert here, but it'll be okay. I think there's a term limitation, right? It's been out now for 13 years, so I think I can make all the spoilers I want. But at any rate, Malkovich, of course, is an actor, but once Craig takes over his body, he gives up acting and becomes a puppeteer. At any rate, in that part of the film, right, does it seem clear, and I'll put this question to you, I mean, you haven't seen it, but you, I think, get the idea. Doesn't it seem clear there that who we'd be looking at on the screen, even though it looks like John Malkovich's body, is really Craig Schwartz? Right, because Craig Schwartz is the puppeteer, now he's simply, you know, operating that body, we might say. So that'd be Craig Schwartz at that point. And philosophers use thought experiments like that, or considerations like that, to suggest that, yes, what is in fact important about personal identity is psychological continuity. We would say that that John Malkovich body is actually Craig Schwartz because there's sort of a line you could draw that's continuous from Craig Schwartz to John Malkovich in terms of personality, in terms of memories, right? And that's what makes that person Craig Schwartz rather than John Malkovich. Does that make sense? Okay. We later learn in the film that the Malkovich body is in fact a vessel that will eventually contain the consciousnesses of a group of people. So there's this whole sort of backstory that we're not getting here, even in the film, but somehow John Malkovich's body is this vessel, and a whole group of, I don't know, it's about 20 people, when John Malkovich's body is ripe, is what they say, they're going to all enter it en masse and live in Malkovich, and then they will jump to another vessel. It's a way for them to live forever. They keep jumping from body to body.
So do they have their own portals?
They're like you and I. They're just regular people, and but they know about this portal that we saw. And so when Malkovich's body is ripe, and you see this later in the film, they're all going to enter that portal, and so they won't die because they're now in this body. Okay. When that happens, again, the question of personal identity would be in need of resolution, right? Because later in the film, you actually see toward the end of the film, John Malkovich's body, but there, of course, we understand, you know, it's 20-odd consciousnesses in that body. Who is that? Okay. Most people, I think, would say, well, it's not Malkovich anymore, right? He's been pushed aside. But could there really be, would we say it's 30 people that we're looking at? Would we say it's the one who's sort of, you know, at the joystick controlling Malkovich at the time? You know, we're not clear on that, perhaps. And at the very end of this film, the next vessel after Malkovich's body is going to be Malkovich's body's offspring. So in the film, you see that later there's this daughter that's born. And it's kind of difficult to describe whose daughter it is. I've written here, the daughter of Malkovich's body. Okay. At any rate, Craig Schwartz gets trapped inside of that body. He cannot control this little girl, and he will never be able to control the little girl according to the story in the film, but he can perceive everything she perceives, like we saw here in this clip. Okay? And at that point, we would wonder, I think, well, who is that? Right? Because it's one body, but it has two consciousnesses in it. And I don't, again, I don't know that the answer to that question is clear. One of the reasons I really like to show this film to my students is because, of course, it's hilarious. I mean, this clip was funny, but there are lots of other funny scenes in here. But by the end of the film, students have unwittingly, I think, become much less clear about something they've probably always taken for granted, that they are who they are and who they always have been. The fact that this thought experiment is on film and it's particularly funny makes engaging them with these puzzles just that much easier. But I think this film even does better than that because it suggests a philosophical position on personal identity that challenges the widely held view that personal identity amounts to psychological continuity, which I said earlier, right? In other words, if you think about any of these body-switching films or ideas, typically people want to say, well, we know that this person is actually Craig Schwartz because the personality is there now in Malkovich's body, so that's really Craig Schwartz. But this film, I think, suggests that it's not just psychological continuity that's important. it's also the fact that somebody who's in control of a body makes a difference. So I think this film suggests that it's psychological continuity and, we might say, a control criterion of identity. It's not just whose thoughts and memories and so forth are in a particular body, but also who's in control of that body. Both of these things work together to help us figure out who are we looking at here. Who is this on the screen or that we're encountering?
Well, in that sense, if control decrees some sort of nature of identity, then by the end, even though Craig Schwartz is in the daughter's body, he's
right.
only an observer.
Right.
So she is still whomever she would be.
Exactly. And I think that's how most people would intuitively read that scene, right? And we don't have to go to that. In the clip you just saw, right? It's basically the same scenario where Craig Schwartz is simply a passive observer of what Malkovich is doing, right? But John Malkovich is in control. He's wiping his teeth and so forth. In that scene, right, aren't we intuitively thinking, well, this is John Malkovich when we see the Malkovich body, and Craig Schwartz is just sort of catching her eye, I guess, or something like that, right? So it does seem, even though we might say in that body there are two consciousnesses, there's just the one person, and it's the person who's in control. And that's something that some philosophers are, you know, I'm actually not familiar with any philosopher that really has recognized the importance of control and not just psychological continuity is important to personal identity.
Well, and they even, there's a funny scene where they start selling essentially roller coaster rides on John Malkovich. You know,
yeah.
Where there's this scene of, you know, people, you know, standing in line out in the hallway waiting to go through the portal. You know, and the whole, you know, selling point is the thrill ride of being John Malkovich.
Mm-hmm. The next scene there, right, we just saw a clip where Catherine Keener's character, Maxine, is calling Craig Schwartz, the person who said, hey, why don't you commit suicide if you're so, you know, upset with the way things have just turned out. But at any rate, she calls him up because she has this idea, hey, we can make money off of this. She undergoes quite the character transformation in the film because she's this very crass, commercial person at the beginning. She's actually kind of homophobic. By the end of the film, she's involved in a lesbian relationship, and she's, you know, very caring, very nurturing, and so forth. So there's that element of the film going on as well. People are changing while staying in the same body, and it, you know, raises that other question. She's still the same person that she was at the beginning of the film as she is to the end because she's acting so differently.
Isn't she the mother of the daughter?
She is the mother of the daughter of Malkovich's body.
Right. and which to Craig Schwartz is part of the allure is that he still actually gets to be with the Catherine Keener character as he's growing up in the daughter's body.
Yes, that's why he entered the daughter's body. It's very complicated. At any rate, yeah, see the whole film and it does start to make sense. It does, really. Waking Life that you saw last, if some of you were here last night, Waking Life is another film we watched, and that doesn't necessarily start to make sense by the end, but it's still a good film. what I did want to say, though, is, you know, okay, interesting, personal identity, you know, let's you know, think about these strange issues regarding personal identity. But this film and these questions of personal identity do have clear implications for the possibility of life after death, which, of course, as Christians, you know, we'd probably be interested in. For life after death to be possible, we must be able to account for personal identity in a way that we could be the same person after death somehow. And this is one of the reasons we might want to think about this. How could that work? Okay. Craig Schwartz in this clip mentions the soul and so forth, right? And that's a possibility that you know, has been embraced by various Christians down through the ages. But I would argue, you know, looking at other philosophers, that, you know, soul is really an inadequate sort of vehicle for personal identity. That our bodies are also important. And I think that this film kind of really raises some interesting questions about that. Overall, I think that we'll just have to trust in God's grace that we're going to be able to survive death. And in exactly what form, maybe that's not so clear, though it might be fun to think about. Films such as Being John Malkovich can help us think about those possibilities. Just want to throw that at you there at the end. Any other comments or questions about this one? Yeah.
I guess I didn't comment.
Yeah.
About personal identity, that almost seems to me like it could also, it could be kind of like a joke or an allegory of how people are made up of different influences in their lives and different personalities. And then when the marketing gets involved, how easy it is to manipulate people that way.
Yeah. The media's ability to influence people and that kind of thing we're going to touch on tomorrow, but that isn't so present here. What's really happening in this film is that Craig Schwartz is this very talented puppeteer, right? So he just is able to take control. And we don't get a sense as to what's influencing Craig other than, which you alluded to earlier, his desire to be with Maxine that we saw. And that sort of motivates all of his actions. Through the entire film. But yeah, thanks.
Some things never change.
For certain individuals. Yeah. Other questions? Or? Okay, well, thanks for coming out. Yeah. Two pages of bibliography here and two pages of filmography if you're interested in other films to watch, books, other resources to look at there.
Where did you get your course?
Everett Community College.
Oh, that's right.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it isn't. I kind of teach it in this weird schedule, so it's not as popular. I mean, for me, that's personally a good thing, so I don't get overwhelmed with students. But yeah, it's fun, for sure. Yes. They do. I am the philosophy department there. I'm the only person who teaches philosophy there, so... is it Nicholas?
I think they
oh, is that right? Okay, Richard Burton? Are you thinking of Richard Burton?
Maybe that's him.
Okay, he, as far as I know, he moved on to a union position. So I don't know if they let him go or whatever, but anyway. Yeah. So
it's good that Everett still has that.
Yeah, they have to get rid of the program if, you know, to get rid of me, so they might try that. Anyway. Thanks. Yeah, I should get your name. What was your name?
Chris. Yeah, but unfortunately I'm leaving tomorrow.
Okay.
Just to go on an out for the rest of the week. So
okay,
you don't have to do it without me.
All right. Well, I appreciate your comments and questions.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
Good.
It reminded me, and I don't remember the name of the movie, but the whole body possession thing, a very funny movie, the old Steve Martin, Lily Tomlin.
Oh,
movies.
Yeah.
Part of Me.
The Man with Two Brains.
Yeah, that's it. Man with Two Brains, yeah.
Yeah.
But but it's a very funny take on that whole idea.
Yes.
Cinematic.
I haven't seen that in a long time.
I haven't either. But
yeah.
Yeah, and I probably wouldn't even have thought about it if Willie Tomlin had not.
No,
been
this
hard.
Is.
Yeah, good
this
point.
Is,
I just remember this one disturbing scene in that. Which involves lipstick, and I won't go any further than that.
Yeah. Well, it certainly highlighted Steve Martin's ability as a physical actor.
Okay. I should look at that one again.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. It's probably since it came out either. But, yeah.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said the Agora, too, right?
It's just Agora. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No,
yeah, that one I ran across that one rather randomly.
Okay.
At the Crest Theater is
Shoreline. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I would actually, I was kind of joke yesterday about Slacker being the most philosophical movie ever
really?
Made. But no, it's just on the Richard Linklater thing.
Yeah, yeah. Have you seen Waking Life?
I have. Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
because there's that one scene there. I think there's that connection with Slacker with the convenience store clerk. And microwaving the burrito. I don't know. Anyway,
yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, there's a lot of just kind of overlaps of, I mean, even that scene you showed of like people walking down the street having a conversation. There's
right.
a lot of that in both of those movies.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
Yeah. And Richard Linklater, too.
Right.
You know, so, yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah. Where do you teach at Seattle Central?
Hey,
Joel.
Part-time.
Oh, okay.
Work
ah.
in the store.
Oh yeah,
selling that book.
Has it been there all summer?
No.
Okay.
No, it arrived sometime last week.
Oh okay.
And it was put on the shelves on Saturday.
Okay. All right. I'll push it every night. So.
Are there, most of these films seem, that you've shown clips, are rather direct in talking about things raising philosophical questions.
Right, I know the word
and
philosophy.
I'm wondering, are there any films that you like where they're not so, where it's more indirect?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Which?
Yeah, let me refresh my memory here. Well, like 12 Angry Men, for example.
Okay.
I mean, I've used that one to just look at the nature of scientific truth, you know, or empirical attempts to find truth. Let's see here. The Battle of Algiers tomorrow, I think, is something that, I mean, you could watch the whole film and you think you're just, well, I'm watching this historical drama, you know, about this particular battle. But the way that... the director pulls it off, I think is very interesting, has a lot of suggestions of postmodern perspectives on truth. And so that one's, yeah, totally indirect.
Pontecorvo.
Yes.
That's the thing. It looks like a documentary, but it isn't.
Right. Right. And the very first thing, and I'll reference this tomorrow, but the very first thing in the film is to say that there were absolutely no reels of documentary footage used in this film. So it kind of denies, you know, that at the beginning, although, again, yeah, it's set up that way.
And it does use some of the real players.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the actual battle.
Right. Let's see. Well, Last Year at Marienbad is really a challenging film. You've seen it then?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, I haven't actually shown that in my class in a long time, but when I saw it, I think... To me, it suggests like it's sort of the embodiment of a solipsistic outlook. To me, it's just like, what if the entire universe were just your consciousness? This might be a way it looks, I guess. It's the way, I don't know. It's sort of a very poetic, I guess, film, you know, and so I think that's certainly indirect if you're going to get any philosophical message out of that. I haven't used it in a long time. Yeah. El Angel, Exterminador, the Exterminating Angel.
Oh, good grief. Buñuel.
Yeah.
Buñuel.
Yeah. That one is definitely indirect and you know, surrealist and so forth. But I like to wrestle with that one about and deal with that one in terms of the meaning of life. You know, he's got this definite class structure there in the film. And, you know, I used that one. It's been a while since I've done that one, but I used that one in conjunction with Aristotle, I think, and the whole idea that I think the whole dinner party is sort of like life, you know, we're trapped here, and so what are we going to make of it?
Then you get trapped in the church.
Right, yes, yes, I know, which is just a delicious ending there. Fight Club is an interesting one, and at this film festival that I organized, I had a person come and talk about that, and he really opened my eyes to the fact that the whole thing is a Buddhist allegory, and it's a Buddhist film. I know, with that in mind, review it, and it came across that way the time I viewed it after that. This really is a Buddhist film. But you have to go into it thinking of it that way.
I wonder what Buddhists would think.
Yeah, I know it's very violent. But, yeah, let's see. Oh, Blade Runner. It's not necessarily as indirect as other films, but have you seen Blade Runner?
Not the director's cut.
Okay.
The one with the voiceover.
Okay.
I don't know which do you prefer.
I do the director's cut. If I use that film in conjunction with an essay by John Searle on artificial intelligence, where John Searle is suggesting that artificial intelligence is just could never possibly, you know, be like real. I mean, it's always going to be any computer attempting to mimic human thinking is just going to be doing that, mimicking human thinking. But he makes this exception for biological material. I mean, for him to be able to think necessitates biological material being involved. In Blade Runner, you've got these androids, but they're made out of biological material, so it really kind of throws that question open as to, well, could they think then, just because they happen to be engineered out of, you know, this carbon-based matter rather than computer chips. So, anyway, that was one. Run, Lola, Run is also indirect. Have you seen that one, German film?
I know about it, but...
Yeah. So basically the idea is it's just sort of this 20-minute sequence that keeps happening three different times, and the main character, Lola, sort of goes through it three times, and each time she kind of changes something, and things happen in a different way. So it's sort of got Rashomon, I don't know, qualities, I guess, but she's actually sort of exerting her will in how things are happening. And I use that one to discuss fate versus free will, or determinism and free will.
That's more like Groundhog's Day.
Yeah, yes, it is. It's kind of like that. And I really prefer it to Groundhog Day. I mean, I like Groundhog Day okay, but, you know, it just doesn't, for me anyway, it never generated sort of, oh yeah, philosophic, you know, some philosophic wondering. I just sort of laughed more than anything else.
Well, it's more exploitation. He's trying to connect with Andy McDowell.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
But it takes him thousands upon thousands of times to work it.
Yeah. And it kind of has, you know, the standard Hollywood ending of, oh, he learned his valuable lesson and now he can move on. And I much prefer the exterminating angel to that. so, at any rate, I like Run, Lola, Run a lot for fate and free will and those two perspectives getting looked at there. The Wicker Man, have you seen that one, the original? Or the remake is awful, so hopefully you haven't seen that one. But
no, I've definitely not seen the remake.
Okay.
But I'm trying to remember if I saw the original. It's not coming to me right now.
Okay. That's this one that takes place on a Scottish island, and there's this sort of strange pagan religion that's going on there, and a missing girl and so forth. So no, that doesn't look like it's ringing any bells. There's also a lot of nudity and sex in that. But
oh boy.
Yeah. It's really a good film, actually, though. It raises some interesting questions about faith versus reason, because basically the film as this Christian police officer confronting a pagan society. And the way the film treats both religions seriously, but what's interesting is that both religions look, according to the film, equally unreasonable. I don't want to say too much, because I think it's a great film, and that's one where, yeah, I could spoil things if I say too much. But at any rate, yeah, that's another one I really like to show. So, I don't know. Yeah.
Good.
All right. So how long are you in the village?
One more week. Maybe a week from today.
Oh, okay. And you arrived
2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
From today.
All right. Okay. Have you been before then? You said, yeah, you'll show those films when they let you. So.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
It's Bollywood films.
Right.
Apparently you haven't found too much philosophical in Bollywood films.
I haven't, you know, like I said yesterday, I haven't had the time to look at a lot of them. I would certainly be open to that. I'd like to get in my class, you know, I'd like to have a variety of genres, and I'd like to get a musical. Run Lola Run is kind of, it's almost like a music video for 80 minutes, so it's kind of musical, but it would be nice to have that genre represented. In Bollywood, it's, of course, a unique variant of that.